the big one out.
I think rather better subject. I think it's probably worth rather more, and I would think this is probably worth more like 2 to 3 thousand pounds. So we have a parameter that could be worth anything between 3 to 5 thousand pounds.
They look rather nice, don't they?
Well, it's absolutely right. It's lost its plinth, the bottom section of the plinth here, and clearly over the years damp has affected the wood, and the colour has rather gone here. You've got a sort of damp, almost a filmy, foggy look on the wood. And if we come up from the base and come up to the door, which here, which is a wonderful piece of quarter cup Cuban mahogany, if we get the light on it a bit better, but you can see the figure of the wood. The best part was kept for the door, best view. But the whole clock would have had much more of this type of colouring before the damp.
It's a good warm colour, isn't it?
Yeah. Inside, interesting enough, and probably because of the damp, somebody stained it all. And originally, this is oak. It's an oak backboard. Mahogany sides, but this has all been stained up.
Is that the original back?
Oh, yes.
Right.
Now we'll come up to the top and
you've got to ask questions.
It's missing a whole section of the
top.
If you actually stand back from the clock and look at it, it's disproportionately long here, the whole shape. And it doesn't look well proportioned. It looks rather stunted on the top and squat on the bottom. So you put 3 inches on the bottom and 8 or 9 inches on the top. Then you have a long, typical London long case clock on 1760, 1770. This is the classic, what we call a London mahogany long case clock. This particular one is signed by Conyers. We can't believe it. I'll just move it on an hour there. It's an odd name. Got a nice strike too. Conyers Dunlop was a top of the second division maker. He wasn't up with the best London makers, Graham, etc., but he was one of the best of the sort of second division. And I think he started in the clockmaker's company as early as about 1725 or something like that. And he died in 1779. So this would be 1760-ish. One thing I should point out about the dial is that originally the chapter ring here, this ring, strike, the silent ring, second ring, and this plaque would all have been silvered. It really needs to be in the hands of a top case maker, a restorer, to redo the colouring of the base, to refit the base at the top. You need a fairly good ceiling, by the way, to get it in. But if it was put back to its right, and the case was restored well, and the dial was redone, then you're looking at a clock that certainly is worth the duration of £6,000 to £7,000 in fine condition, because it's a top clock. But at the moment, it's just looking a bit sad. It's that sort of indetermable quality that they put into such shapes in the 18th century. And you've got
somebody who actually
could do it. Makes you wonder how much ours is worth. Not as much as that, obviously, but... Is it? No, I don't think it is.
Much about it, how old is it or anything?
Well, it is an 18th century one, but it's had some later additions. I mean, you would expect to see some restoration. It's been upholstered in the back there at some time.
This is the first photograph of my great-grandparents actually sitting in the chair.
Well, there's a cushion. There's the cushion.
There's the cushion that's on the chair, yeah.
That was nailed on, then you can see where it was now. Oh, 100 years after the chair was made. See, the chair was made about 1780, so it's an 18th century chair.
Mm-hmm.
So it was already 100 years old before they were sitting in. Isn't that lovely?
Yeah.
The value is not terribly high. I mean, around the sort of £1,200 mark, which isn't great these days, and considering its age. But it is rather more a value to you.
That's right, it's sentimental value. That's right, right, yeah.
But a lovely thing, and thank you for letting me see it.
Quite all right.
It actually was a wedding gift to my mother's grandmother in 1908.
Right.
She worked in the Staffordshire Pottery and it was specially decorated for her.
That's very interesting because superficially one would have thought this was a much earlier piece. The style of the figure is part of the early part of the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
It belongs essentially in its form to the 1840s or 50s.
Mm-hmm.
I should say, of course, this is what is conventionally called a Staffordshire flatback. Typical Staffordshire production in a range of factories through the 19th century. Flatback so called because normally when you turn these figures round, the back was flat, unmodelled, from a simple mould, and of course undecorated. So this is remarkable in that it has decoration on the back, designed to be seen in the round. It is also remarkable in the quality of the decoration, which is far, far better than one would expect from a piece of this time. Effectively, the revival of interest in matters Scottish was very much due to Queen Victoria and Prince Albert. Tartans were revived, they of course built a castle at Balmoral, Prince Albert designed his own tartan, and there was a whole consciousness about the North British culture which revived the time.
Have you had your pill?
And indeed, there is something in the face that has the look of Prince Albert himself. A figure that doesn't represent anybody in particular, but simply a generic type, is, I'm afraid, less valuable than one that one can clearly say is a person of history. So in terms of value, I mean, we're talking about anything between £200 to £300.
Yeah, we understood that would be less sort of value, but it's something that you couldn't have, you couldn't bring on.
The date is difficult, but yes, that you're talking somewhere around about 1900. This idea of, you know, people always getting married in white, of course, was quite recent. It wasn't until Queen Victoria set the fashion for getting married in white that people really thought that it was the thing to do. Before that, they would just wear a very smart outfit. It didn't have to be white at all. One always assumes that white lace or cream lace was for a wedding dress, but it wasn't always. It was for a ball gown or a presentation dress at court or anything.
Because these were often sailors' gifts. So when the wife was rolling out her flower or whatever, she might think of her husband at sea. It's called a decalcomania. And what the Victorian ladies would have done in the 1870s and 1880s is to cut out these scraps in here, and then working through this tiny little hole at the top, they would apply them on the inside and put in salt or chalk, hence the calcum for decalcomania. To secure them there. And they're very popular indeed in the auction world at the moment. I think if this went up for sale, it would make between £300 and £400.
Yes, it is. It's Mrs. Bloomer. She was an American lady who came over here and promoted trousers for women. She was the first women's liver, sort of. And of course, they were used for cycling in. And she takes things from the 1880s, somewhere around there. And actually it's quite a rare figure, quite a desirable one. And it's actually in incredibly good state. It's really crisp and clean. I should have about £300 to £400.
A little preserved, John.
Writing that down with the thing.
Made in England. Well, this type of decoration, these crinoline ladies, very popular in the 1920s, the 1930s. I think it was a sort of reaction to the modern woman, you know, when it was stylish to raise your skirts and bob your hair.
Oh, he's got a red rose now.
Give me all that one, but it's worth
it. Yeah.
It's nice that you haven't over-cleaned it. I mean, I like to see all this varnish. It's very good. Because they were originally painted. All these Windsor chairs were usually painted dark green, either to go in the garden or the courtyard.
And the idea was because they were green wood when they were made, and if you drop them, they burnt. And they didn't break, so they only sprung together. Now we leave our experts and the people of York just for a moment for me to tell you about the Radio Times competition and to remind you, of course, that every week you stand the chance of winning a voucher, which you can then exchange for £2,500 worth of antiques, so it's well worth having a go. Why not? First of all, the answer to last week's question. And the question was, what is the name of the silversmith who made this cow creamer? And the answer is John Shoupe. And now to this week's object, should I say, very pretty porcelain cup and saucer, decorated very appropriately with a design known as the Tea Party. It's a marvellous evocation of that period in the 18th century when tea drinking had recently become a well-established and popular habit. Now, the interesting thing about this cup and saucer is the means of decoration, which has been printed rather than painted. So unlike the familiar blue and white porcelains, these examples were decorated by printing in enamel over the glaze. It was a technique pioneered in England during the middle of the 18th century and copied by several factories. But the interesting thing about this is that nowhere was it more prolifically or successfully used than in this particular factory, which became known as one of the most popular and enduring sites of English porcelain manufacture. And so to the question, in which factory was this cup and saucer made? Now, to help you, it's probably a good idea to look at a copy of next week's Radio Times, which gives you more details of the competition and even a few suggested answers. And then your entry needs to be postmarked before next Saturday and sent, please, to the Radio Times, not to the Antiques Roadshow. And then you'll stand a chance of winning that antiques voucher that I mentioned to the value of £2,500. Another question next week, and of course the answer to this competition. In the meantime, back to our experts and the people of York.
Where did you get them from?
From the auction of York. I pay this large purse about £300.
About £300?
Yeah.
Right. Well, I tell you why I thought it would be interesting to look at these, because they are of a type of porcelain which is coming over to this country in enormous quantities, and it's coming from South Korea and Taiwan. They are usually in the style of Canton, like this, 19th century Canton. And the worrying thing about them, as far as we're concerned, is that very often they've got on the mark, on the base, spurious rain marks. And this one, in fact, the rain mark of the Emperor Qin Lung. But they are not, I'm afraid, of that period. The characteristic about them is this very orangey mud look that you get smeared onto the bottom, and often actually over the body as well. They're being sold by interior decorators, by china shops, and multiple stores. And a pair like that, you would have to pay about £150 for. And frankly, if you go to a pudgy auction and the piece is not dated, you need to go to ask the auctioneer himself, what date are these pieces? And if he says he doesn't know,
them from my grandma. When I was a child, I can remember them on the mantelpiece.
Yeah, and I've been studying Rockingham for 30 years and I have never seen this shape before, and it's really quite remarkable. We know the Rockingham, not because of the mark on the bottom here, there you can see it. Rockingham worked a Bramall in this little cartouche there, which is the crest of Earl Fitzwilliam. By the time these were made, which is about 1826-28, he was actually the owner of the Rockingham factory. It was started in Swinton, in Yorkshire, near Rotherham. They're nicely painted with flowers, not brilliant, but it's this lovely shape, similar to the Chinese shape, very simple, very stylized, and that very, very early mark from the first 4 years of porcelain production. So, the usual question, have you any idea of their value?
No.
Well, as I've never seen anything like them before, I'm a little taking on the value, but they have two minute cracks. I mean, they are really minute. They wouldn't detract. So if they went into auction and the Rockingham collectors saw them, they would go for them. I would be very surprised if they didn't make £1,500, and they could well go to £2,500.
Yeah, actually, my auntie said they weren't worth anything.
Your auntie said they weren't worth anything. Well, go back and tell her. You've been told that they weren't a lot more than you thought.
The works are concentrated on landscape watercolour than the other concentrated on flowers.
Yes. The one we have here is by Alice West.
Yes.
Who's the older sister.
Yes.
That's right, isn't it? And I noticed we have a rather nice drawing of cockatoo, I think it is. Can you tell us anything more about this?
Well, I think it was probably a quick sketch of a commission she was asked to do for Trill Birdseed.
Oh, yes. And I remember Trill, who made Badgers Bounce with Help.
That is it.
That's right.
Mix and Sing.
Yes.
Yes. And this one wasn't chosen.
Well, they're rather lovely. I love this one. I think this is particularly nice and rather lovely colour. Little boy fishing there.
Yeah. Lovely colour.
A nice colouring. Pine mill. Lovely colouring. But goodness, there are an awful lot here. And really mixed subjects. Landscapes, birds. Lovely ones of birds here. Yes. Well, I think they're very, very lovely, those.
Yeah.
Let's move on to her younger sister, who was called Maud.
Maud,
that's
yes.
Right. This is very colourful, isn't it?
Beautiful.
Very
detail.
I suppose that a lot of these were probably done for sort of Christmas cards and things like that.
They did Christmas cards, and the main thing that they were both, well, Maud certainly was engaged on, was the Sutton Seed catalogue.
Oh, yes.
They would send down a courier with
yes.
the most beautiful flowers, and they would. When I was younger, a child, they used to say,
yes.
come and sit in the studio if
incredible.
You like, if you're very good.
But this is beautiful, and I love this one of daffodils here.
There are so many
very
of
colourful.
Daffodils.
And, of course, the nice thing about these folios is that they've obviously been sitting in folios for so long that they're wonderfully fresh, and they haven't been subjected to sunlight, and therefore they haven't faded, they haven't lost any of their colour. I think that's one of my favourites. Do you
yes.
like that one too?
Yes, I do. This vivid orange is in the narcissus.
Very vivid colours. But they're such nice quality. I think my own personal opinion is that probably Maud was the better artist. Would
I
you
felt
agree
so.
With that?
Yes,
yes,
yes I would.
I think. And this
now, this is one I'm particularly fond of.
Yes, isn't that lovely?
I have four at home, up in a frame.
In terms of date, we're talking about anything. They're probably done between about 1890 and 1940,
yes.
would that be about right? Yes.
Yes.
They're terribly difficult to value, really, these, because all folios are very difficult to value, because there's some that are probably worth quite a lot of money and other little bits that are probably worth a few pounds. But I think you told me that there are, is it 65 or 70 of each? And my feeling is that probably Alice's folio would be worth somewhere in the region of £2,000 to £3,000. That would be a conservative estimate. But I think Maud's, I think, with the rather more saleable and beautiful flower pictures, I think is in excess of £5,000, and probably rather more than that. I mean, I feel that some of the better ones could be worth in the high hundreds, and perhaps the lesser ones, you know, in the £50 range. But it's never very easy to
sell.
No, well, I'm sure you don't.
And
they,
the
really,
life.
They really are very beautiful.
You know, I've waited nearly 2 years for a decent bit of woodwork, and here it is. I think it's a very good example of how timber can be ravaged by this little beetle. However, it's not as serious as it looks. This can be built up.
Good Lord.
And the rest of it injected with, first of all, a killing agent. You kill off the beetle, and then you can inject with wood and sawdust and fill up the solid again. So, you know, it isn't something one has to immediately throw hands in the air in horror, because that can be quite easily remedied.
Yes, we nearly didn't bring it on account of that.
Well, I'm very glad you did. I shouldn't have had this to talk about, you
no.
see. It happens to have been infected in that particular piece of the frame, but if you look at the rest of it, this is absolutely wonderful quality. These edges sharp, these blocks dropped in from the top as they probably should be. Mm. And then here, another clamp mark. Now that's a clamp.
I often wonder what those marks were.
Right, that's where they could find a clamp hold to brace it together when they were making it. One very sensible thing to do.
Yeah.
You don't usually see it, but of course on such a shaped seat, it's impossible to clamp and get solid. Wonderful thing, and of course the sort of quality you'd expect to see on a chair made of rosewood, and with a back as beautiful as that. Absolutely stunning design throughout.
Yes.
How long have you had this?
We bought it in about 1956.
You bought what looks like at first glance probably a Victorian chair? But in fact, the design for this chair was drawn and published in 1827. If you look in a book by a man called George Smith, who was a very, very important person at the time, in the 1820s, and he drew pages of designs for chair back in this then new French style. They are absolutely marvellous examples of very, very early Victorian, may even be William IV. And the quality is superb. All this carving, these scrolls are very big, and they were reviving the Rococo period of the 18th century.
Yes.
If you haven't got the chairs insured, then you really ought to have them insured separately, as described as early Victorian, take a photograph of them, keep them as a household insurance, and value them at
£3,500. There's a magpie in there.
This one. This little one here used to meow when I first got him. Still had the original price tag on, although his belt was 40 years old when I acquired him.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. He sort of just purrs and used to meow as well. When he's on a smooth surface, he moves along. I actually see him put him on there. So off he goes. He moves along.
You're clearly a collector. Can I ask you what you do for a living?
Well, I was trained as a scientific instrument maker. Then I joined the professional staff of the Castle Museum for many years, but I've been retired.
Unless you just built this up?
Well, most of these were acquired at the same rate, 40
You were there at the right time?
I was there at the right time, yes. You see. Now I was doing quite a bit of restoring and that.
I don't normally deal with books.
No.
But 25 years ago, I joined a firm of book auctioneers in the City of London as a hoarder. And I've always collected books. And I spotted this and my eyes lit up, really because of the binding.
It's a lovely binding.
It's a wonderful binding. It's been beautifully gold tooled. This green colour, this olive green colour, is very fugitive. And
yes.
Often the sun gets at it and the colour goes.
Exactly.
In fact, actually, the atmosphere does it a bit. And it's in fact by Ramage, who's one of the leading binders.
Yes.
Well, that was exciting enough. But when I opened it, I mean, it was a joy. What we've got here is what we call incunabula.
Yes.
A book from the very early years of printing.
Yes.
Printing started in Europe in the mid-15th century.
Mm-hmm.
And here we've got one which is 1495.
Yes.
And the cut-off date for incunabula is 1500. So you've just crept in.
Yes,
here.
Yes.
The date we in fact can get from this title page, and it's just here, MCCCXCB. Here we've got beautiful engraved wood borders.
That's wood as well, is it?
Yes, it is, absolutely.
Oh,
it's not
yes.
printed from
I assume it was metal.
No, it isn't.
Oh.
This is the finest sort of wood engraving that you can get.
It is metal.
And
yes.
The scenes are sort of mythical animals, scenes of everyday life of the 15th century. And from that point of view alone, it's absolutely charming. And occasionally we get these whole page miniatures
yes.
of scenes illustrated here from the book. And of course it's a book of hours, that
yes.
is a prayer book.
Yes.
Now, what we've got occasionally is a hole. And what's happened here, somebody's actually cut out a miniature illuminated initial.
Yes.
To stick in a book. And this one finds in a lot of manuscripts and printed books.
Oh, now that I knew about that.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And you find whole books, scrapbooks. This is mainly done in the 18th and mostly 19th century. People cut up these old
scrapbooks
books.
Scrapbooks made of them.
Made of them.
Mm-hmm.
Terrible, terrible tragedy.
It is, indeed.
But basically, this thing is in pretty good condition. And of course, it is printed on vellum, which
yes.
is leather, not paper, which
yes,
is much rarer.
Yes.
When did you get it?
I got it at the second-hand booksellers, antiquarian booksellers in Glasgow. So about 1950.
May I ask very rudely what you have to pay for it?
If my memory serves me correctly, 27.10, or 27.50, as we should now say.
£27.10. Right. Today, in fact, this is going to be worth approaching £3,000.
10 times as much.
Goodbye.
No.
100 times
as much.
A very good buy.
Well, I believe there's a bit of family history to this young man portrayed here.
Yes, I believe it is my wife's great-grandfather, called Leonardo Perugini, who had two sons. One was called Carlos Eduardo, and the other was called Eduardo Carlos.
And this is this was painted in Paris?
Yes, the somewhat unusual appearance is probably because it was after an arts ball, and Lord Leighton said to my wife's great-grandfather, "Very genie, I must paint you just as you are."
So
that is the result.
So this painting is by Lord Leighton, which we can see from his signature. In fact, Leighton, soon after this, stopped signing his pictures altogether. But as a young man, he signed with this rather beautiful, complicated monogram FL.
Yes.
He was plain Frederick Leighton, later to become Sir Frederick Leighton, later to become President of the Royal Academy. But here, just a kid having a good time. I would imagine this is about 1855, the first year that Leighton was in Paris. He was there from 1855 to 1858.
Yes.
Perugini, senior, was, I should think, his contemporary. Leighton was 25 years old, and just about to make the great breakthrough. I should think this was painted just before, probably. So here we see the great-grandfather of your wife, a little piece of art history, a little piece of personal history, and a wonderful portrait. Leighton was a great genius. And what is more, Leighton was a Yorkshireman, so born in Scarborough, and so we have something to do with Yorkshire, which is also very nice. He is very much sought after, so I would think this picture would be valued at around £20,000, £20,000,
£25,000. Oh dear, I can't afford the insurance on that, but we'll try. Yes, that sounds like me.
Well, I don't normally use a lid, but I do have it.
Why is that?
Well, normally we've been using this for flower arranging, small flowers, violets and lily of the valley.
I mean, appropriate really for the flower shape, and I suppose especially appropriate a white rose teapot here in York. But to me it's a wonderful little teapot, and this sort of shouting out, "I am made of porcelain," the finest white porcelain made of Meissen, and this a delightful small teapot from that factory. The teapot is in the shape of a flower all the way around. The handle is the stalk. There's the leaves most appropriately formed around to form the spout. I've never seen one done that way. And it stands on three buds as the base. There is the clue to the make and also to the dating of it. There's a small Meissen mark on the bottom of it, the cross swords of Meissen, which is in this case very but small in size, underglazed blue, and straight swords, which put it into the 18th century form of the mark. It's going to be about 1750. The damage on the top of the little bit of a pity, I hope that you should use it for your own enjoyment for flowers. I'd rather see it perhaps cleaned up and repaired on the lid and made into a beautiful look of a white porcelain teapot again. It's a very rare piece of Meissen, so difficult to value. Perhaps 1,500, possibly even a bit more.
Quite surprising.
Well, now, occasionally on the Antiques Roadshow, we discover items of such outstanding beauty and quality that they're really self-selecting. We couldn't possibly leave them out of the programme. And that certainly happened to us earlier when we went on a special visit to Fairfax House, which is a perfectly restored Georgian townhouse in the centre of York, not very far away from here. And we walked into the small drawing room, John and John discovered this.
The most wonderful example of late 17th century marquetry. It's just a superb cabinet of the period. And I'm going to show you inside. There is an arrangement of small doors and cupboards, as one would expect. I mean, this is what you should look for, an exemplary piece. This is cabinet making at its finest. Some of the secret drawers, there are 21 in all. I'm not going to show you all, but it didn't last.
We'd be here half an hour.
I know. And I would enjoy it too.
Yeah.
Look, a little tiny drawer made in 1690. Two dovetails, unsophisticated basically, and yet so crisp, clean, so smart, sharp, and just what it should look like.
For what sort of customer, for what sort of house would trust a beautiful piece of furniture have been made?
Oh, very important and wealthy family. A lord, certainly. An aristocrat of great wealth.
But why would anyone want so many secret drawers? I mean, what could you possibly keep that would need so many drawers?
Lots of little secrets. No, no, no. Really and truly, it was the craft and skill.
Yeah.
One or two were the norm, and then they began to say, well, I've got more than you have. You've seen my cabinet. I've got 21 secret drawers.
So, in a sense, it was the skill of the craftsman being shown off.
Absolutely.
To great advantage.
Yes.
Well, John, I'm delighted that you discovered this, as well as so many other things, during our visit to York. Our grateful thanks, therefore, to Fairfax House and everyone here. It's been a marvellous programme. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as we have. We're off now. We're going to Hertfordshire, where we'll be at the same time next week, and I very much hope that you'll join us. So, until then, from all of us in York,
£25,000. And the man obviously had not the foggiest notion.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't know that he would be able to afford the
insurance.
On how to avoid cycling injuries, the overriding advice being to play it safe.
Every single day, 3 children die, 300 are seriously injured, and more than 3,000 go to hospital, and all because of accidents. In the next 10 minutes, we'll be showing you how to stop your child becoming one of these statistics.
Up to Woodley Common, and we were just riding around over the bumps and things like that. We came out onto a straight, like a woody logs over all over the place. I was riding on the left side, I think, and I hit a bump, and then I just came straight off my bike head first and went into the tree. And then I got up and started walking along, and then just fell over again, and I couldn't talk or anything. I was unconscious. Ian Welsh stayed with me, just instead of the wall and going, he stayed with me. And then Ian and Lee went to try and find the telephone.
We got a phone call from the police just to say that Gary was in hospital. Naturally, we thought broken leg or something of that nature. But when we got to the hospital, obviously, it turned out to be far more serious. They told us he had a broken skull, a double fracture.
The doctor came around eventually and told us that it was really quite serious. And we just had to wait there until, you know, we could see him.
Generally, Gary's in good health now. His mental capabilities are as far as we're concerned, returned to normal. And physically, he's about 90-95% of what he was before he had his accident. We've been on at Gary for about a month before the accident about wearing a cycle helmet. And like all boys of his age, I don't want to be the first. Nobody's going to be laughing at me. That was the sort of reaction we got from him. But now I think he wishes he had been wearing one.
It was purely that he didn't want to look silly. And we tried to persuade him, and he said, well, even if we bought one, he'd probably take it off down the road once he got out. So there really wasn't much point. You know, you can't force them to wear helmets.
At Gareth's school, pupils and teachers alike were shocked to hear about his accident.
I got phoned up about Gareth's accident at the end of half term.
Exmouth, yeah.
And we had an assembly for the whole year, and I gave them the news. There was a feeling, a sense of shock, really, running
would be common?
He was really critically ill. I felt we had to act very quickly. It may sound a bit callous, but we had to actually move whilst people were aware of the accident that happened to Gareth. So within days of Gareth's accident, I got in touch with the road safety people, both locally and countywide.
At the local shops sold out of helmets. Bet the local shops sold out of helmets.
Also, we had a poster competition with safety helmets as prizes. And in most lessons, safety became an issue. At last. Now, you've all paid your money, yeah?
Yeah.
You sure?
Yeah.
Okay, here you go. Because very few people were wearing helmets, those that were stuck out a bit, and youngsters didn't like that. Now, because more than 50% of the pupils are wearing helmets, it's become much more fashionable. They've become very aware that safety helmets do actually save lives.
The local community have joined in the campaign too. There's a scheme to reward careful cyclists with a free helmet, and cycle shops are doing a roaring trade.
It was certainly very traumatic. I wouldn't wish anybody to go through it, really. But it's just quite nice that something positive has come out of it, and that more children are wearing helmets.
Gary's had a serious accident. He appreciates that. And a lot of people in this area have appreciated that. And now a lot of cycle helmets are being worn around the area, which is good. It will hopefully solve the problem of serious head injuries in children. My advice to the children would be, wear a helmet. It certainly does save lives.
Wearing all the right kit is great, but if you're actually planning on going out on the open road, it's a good idea to learn some survival tactics first. This is Cycle Training with a Difference. It's run by the mums and dads.
Really done, well done. Yeah, good on the right shoulder. Okay, a good long look. Away you go, when you're ready. Nice smooth start, that's what we're looking for. No wobbles.
A lot more difficult than it looks. Once they've got to grips with the playground exercises, they learn to deal with the traffic. Your bike, remember, wear reflective clothing so that you can easily be seen. Get some training, buy a helmet and actually wear it. But don't just take my word for it. This is what happened to Gareth's classmate Simon, just a few weeks after Gareth's accident.
Well, I started off winding down the school like any normal day. This car, which was going to overtake but it didn't pull out, so I swerved in. Got my wheel caught in the drain, which took me into the side of the car, and I went over my handlebars, and I hit my head on the pavement, everything stopped, and I closed my eyes to get my senses back, and then my friend came along, helped me up.
Can you show us now then?
Yeah. There it is. Crack down there. Couple of scrapes down there.
So you were lucky you were wearing
it? Yes, I was.
Simon is alive and well today because he was wearing this. But please don't wait until one of your classmates has an accident before you get yourself a cycle helmet. Now, there's more advice on cycle safety and on preventing all kinds of children's accidents in the Play It Safe booklet. For a free copy of the booklet, send a large stamped addressed envelope to Play It Safe, HEA, Newcastle upon Tyne X, NE856DT. In the next program, we'll be looking at water safety and finding out why even children who are good swimmers can still be in danger from water. In the meantime, do remember, play it safe.
Certainly, there are many more people wearing helmets now. Many more wearing helmets. Yes, she did, yeah.
They're back. Jan Francis and Paul Nicholas are just good friends.
5 years ago, you jumped on all motorbike and rode out of my life. Now you think you can buy your way back with a few cheap jokes and a lump of lasagna.
From the moment the wedding was mentioned, your mother took total control. Get him a job at Daddy's firm, membership of the golf club, teach him to sound his H's and respect Volvos. Before you knew it, I'd be in the world's first bionic Tory. Just Good Friends returns on Tuesday at 8 o'clock on BBC One.
For the Money programme on BBC Two in 5 minutes, Brian Barron returns to China for the first major documentary since Tiananmen Square to see if Chinese communism will follow Soviet communism into economic chaos. Here on One in 15 minutes, Martin Bashir joins residents of Kilmarnock in celebrating their town's 400th anniversary with songs of praise.
Yeah, it's the news now, isn't it? Yeah.
First at 6:25, the news with Moira Stewart. This is BBC One.
Police in Moscow have clashed with communist demonstrators demanding the resignation of Boris Yeltsin. Neil Kinnock accuses John Major of misleading the commons over economic growth and the threat to Britain's otters from chemical waste. Good evening. Riot police in Moscow have clashed with communist supporters.
Yeah, well, better go put the flowers in because I put a lot of the plants out this month today. Yeah, I think so.
This used to be called Army Day when the Soviet Union honoured its fighting forces, but the men Boris Yeltsin inspected today.
About 23, she would have said.
23%.
Anyway, what was I saying to you when he was interrupting me with that thing waving in front of me? Oh, yes, that's right. And anybody the father's talking to, he's supposed to sort of have this Walkman on him, which is like umpteen sort of batteries and what have you. Takes conversations. Now, she'll be back again next Friday to pick it up. That's what it was when you know, saying that you were coming back next Friday. That's what it was, because the father said to me, what when is Bridget coming? So I said, well, I don't know. But she's coming and gives him £25 for what he's done. Well, he came into the kitchen. So funny. He came into the kitchen to tell me about this, you see. Bobby.
Well, the worst is, you know, having remembered to take everything and do something.
Anyway, he came back into there and I said, they're not really enthusiastic about the thought. Thinking I was involved with this as well. So the dear woman turned around and said, it's one of your husbands. So I said, well, I've got to go back in the kitchen room where I'm pleased.
Said she, slapping her hand.
I slapped my hand. So anyway, that's, we're going to be, well, he is going to be 25.
I'm not. You'll be £25 better off because you're going
to... Am I getting it?
Yeah. Yes,
well,
because you get £25 worth of vouchers.
Oh, 20 vouchers, is it? Oh, I thought it was money.
Well, I thought it was to start with.
But, I expect something like that, Dixon's. Anyway, so they're coming anyway. Well, I hope that you won't be too long before you reunite with your husband.
So where is he?
He's going to have his at Wendy's, I said to Bridget. We said no, because I'm...
Wendy's?
Yeah, because he's taking David up to Andover, which is his next posting.
Oh, I see.
David sort of phoned him up and said, will you take us up there? Cheek, isn't it really? Maybe he could have got the train from there. I got all this... Yeah, all right.
Oh.
All is forgiven. But no... Yes.
When's he come back tomorrow?
So he'll be back later on tonight, obviously. Yeah. And you're on early tomorrow. Oh, well. Yeah. Okay. What?